Professor Alan Dershowitz has been called the best-known criminal lawyer in the world, having just retired from Harvard University Law School after 50 years. Professor Dershowitz has led a high-profile career in academia, constitutional and criminal law, fiction writing, and as a media personality. He's represented a series of celebrity clients, including Mike Tyson, Patty Hearst, Jim Baker, Klaus von Bülow, and was part of the O.J. Simpson so-called Dream Team. Alan Dershowitz is a staunch supporter of the Democratic Party and has surprised many with his view that there is no case for obstruction of justice charges to be brought against President Trump. He has been outspoken on what he suggests is, in many instances, a virtual campaign to have the president removed. His latest book is called Trumped Up: How Criminalization of Political Differences Endangers Democracy.
There has never been a time in American history like this, where we have such unpredictability and such division. There is no such thing as truth any longer in dialogue. There's Republican truth, there's Democratic truth, there's Trump truth, there's anti-Trump truth. Nobody is listening to the other side. If you want to hear Trump truth, you turn on Fox News. If you want to hear anti-Trump truth, you turn on CNN News. But there's hardly any place one can go to get, I guess it's Harvard's slogan, Veritas, the absolute truth.
Why is the United States in this situation? What are the factors that have led to such an extreme polarization?
It's very hard to discern any particular set of factors. Of course, the Trump people blame it on the 8 years of Obama. I don't think that's correct. Obama was a great, in my view, domestic president and a very mediocre foreign policy president, a mixed legacy, a mixed record. But the fact that he was our first African-American president, I think, exacerbated divisions and tensions that were already beneath the surface. And I think the right is moving further right toward the alt-right. The left is moving further left toward the hard left, and the center is suffering, and it's the center that lends stability to any nation.
Is this also a consequence of the paralysis of Washington, D.C., the Capitol, the House and Senate, for the better part of a decade or more? And is there a way through that?
Paralysis is the excellent description of the American constitutional system. Our system was not built for efficiency. It was built on a system of checks and balances, which often produces a paralysis, particularly when you have a situation where the extremes are battling each other. There's no institutional reason for paralysis right now. We have a president who's a Republican. We have House of Representatives, the Senate, the Supreme Court is dominated by Republicans. State legislatures are dominated by Republicans. There ought to be an opportunity for the Republicans to get their agenda through. During much of the Democratic administrations of the past, Clinton and Obama, the legislative branch was controlled by the opposing party. That explains paralysis. But there's no excuse for paralysis now, except that the Republicans are so deeply divided among the anti-Trump Republicans and the pro-Trump Republicans.
The key theme, including when we've spoken to you previously, is that no matter how much a person objects to this president, he can't just be removed. We have talked, and let's talk about it again, because this investigation continues, mm-hmm. the special prosecutor investigation. We have talked about what it would take for a president to be impeached. Also, whether the 25th Amendment of the Constitution relating to physical or mental incapacity might be mm-hmm, activated. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Does it remain your view that in neither of these instances are we anywhere near the constitutional threshold?
We're nowhere near the constitutional threshold. The American system was designed to have a president in office 4 or 8 years. It is very difficult to remove a president, unlike prime ministers, unlike in a legislative system where you have a vote of non-confidence. It's very difficult, near impossible. We've only had one president removed in our history, President Nixon, and he did it by resignation, though he would have been impeached had he not resigned. We're not anywhere near the 25th Amendment. The 25th Amendment was designed for physical and very severe mental incapacity of the kind. We once had a Secretary of Defense named James Forrestal, who was a psychotic, paranoid schizophrenic. He jumped out of the window and killed himself, thinking that Russian planes were about to attack him. That's the kind of incapacity, or a stroke, or some kind of a very serious physical illness. It was not intended to rid the country of an eccentric president, or a president who doesn't play by the rules, or who some psychiatrists believe has a narcissistic personality. So the 25th Amendment is really off the table. Impeachment, of course, is largely political. If the Democrats were to win an overwhelming legislative victory in 2018, it is possible that they would do what the Republicans did to President Clinton, and that is impeach him. It's easy to impeach. It's almost impossible to remove. All you need is a majority of one house, the lower house. If the Democrats had a majority, they might very well impeach, but there'd be no chance of getting the two-thirds that is required for removal from office. So it would be just a political game, and it didn't work for the Republicans when they went after Clinton, and it wouldn't work for the Democrats if they went after Trump.
A final question on this issue, because comments attributed to Steve Bannon, for the former senior advisor to the president, in Michael Wolff's book, the suggestion attributed to Bannon is that that would be business dealings, family business dealings, that might ultimately pose the biggest threat to this president. Again, outside of impeachment, as you explain, a political action, is that another risk down the track?
It's a risk. Obviously, it's not within the ambit of what the special prosecutor, special counsel is supposed to look for, but if he stumbles onto something that would suggest financial improprieties in the very extensive business holdings that the Trump family has and Jared Kushner has, that could create a situation where the president himself decided to resign as part of a deal not to be prosecuted. That's what happened to Spiro Agnew, who was the vice president of the United States under Nixon. And he was taking bribes when he was the governor of Maryland. And that was discovered during an investigation. And in order not to be impeached, removed, and then prosecuted, he agreed to resign and the prosecutors agreed to let him off the hook. That is a conceivable scenario, but I think extremely unlikely.
So there is a polarizing president. Let's accept that as something I think we can agree is a fact.
Yes.
How are some of these other fundamental institutions either responding to that or fractures within them beginning to be revealed as a result of that? And I'm talking specifically about media and public discourse. We'll come to the justice system in a moment. Mm-hmm. But the level of debate, the nature of debate appears... Mm-hmm. How would you define it in your own experience of it?
Well, I don't think we're having debate. I crave the good old days when I used to debate people like William Buckley. You'd have a liberal debating a conservative, and people would really listen. Today, there's no debate. There are just shouting matches, and there's presentation of one side to an echo chamber and then the other side to an echo chamber, and never the twain shall meet. So I don't think we're having effective discourse. I don't think the media is serving, as it should, as an effective check and balance on a president who desperately needs to be checked and balanced. The judiciary only comes in very, very late. It's an ultimate check and balance, but we're not there yet. The judiciary, you know, may strike down parts of the president's Muslim ban, as the Democrats call it, or as he calls it, a ban on terrorists coming into the country. So the judiciary will play a role. But right now, what's needed is checks and balances from other institutions, the media, the academy, the church. And we're not getting it because we're seeing people shouting at each other rather than speaking to the people.
So we have a 24/7 competitive media environment that has a lot of space to fill. And we have social media that the mainstream media is also up and competing against. Mm-hmm. Are we stuck now in this situation? What does get public discourse or the ability to have discourse at all back on track.
Well, I think there is a potential for that. I would like to see more dialogue, discourse, and debate. I'd love to see more of that. I think we can learn. The United States can learn from New Zealand, from Australia, from Great Britain, from France, from other countries where there is more dialogue and more debate than we have in our country. Maybe part of it is that you have a parliamentary system, which has, I think in your case, five parties, and other countries maybe two or three or seven, because we have only the red and the blue, and they tend to be moving in further directions from the center. Discourse is very difficult in our country, much more so, I think, than in yours.
You've called the judicial system in the U.S. Well, in one instance, I saw you use the word corrupt. Mm-hmm. How so?
We have a very corrupt system at the low levels because we have elected judges and elected prosecutors. And we made a terrible, terrible mistake during the Jacksonian period of our American history back in the 1830s. We tried to bring democracy to all aspects of government, and democracy has no role to play in the judiciary or in the role of prosecutors. Prosecutors should be appointed from the most distinguished lawyers. Judges should be appointed and should be done on a nonpartisan basis. But when you elect people to these roles, you also have to allow them to finance their elections. And they become beholden, like politicians do, to those who contribute. And so you have parts of the United States where you cannot get a fair trial unless you hire a lawyer who's contributed massively to the judge or to the prosecutor. And that's a kind of deep corruption that has alienated many Americans from our legal system.
When you look back on your career in the courtroom, some very high-profile cases, probably mm-hmm. the one that's best known, although I don't think you've described it as a precedent-setting case, but probably one that is best known, of course, is the O.J. Simpson mm-hmm. case. And again, what are your observations on how well the system in its entirety is holding up? Our main memory of that here, as it was in the States, was that this was a media circus first and a trial second. Did that or does that impact on justice?
It certainly does. I think if there had been not a jury but a judge, O.J. Simpson almost certainly would have been convicted. There was sufficient evidence of guilt to convict him. But we, the defense, caught the prosecutors in a corrupt planting of evidence. They manufactured a piece of evidence, a sock that was found on the floor near O.J. Simpson's bed. And they, the police, poured the blood of O.J. Simpson and his victims on the sock to create a piece of evidence which they believe would substitute for the glove, which was an authentic piece of evidence, but they believe would be kept out of court by the judge because it was improperly discovered. And we caught them, and we caught them planting that evidence, and the jury said, essentially, we're not going to convict somebody, guilty or innocent, who has been subjected to evidence tampering. So it exposed a deep flaw in our system, but also a deep check in our system. The jury is what brought about that result. You can ask the question, is it a just result or an unjust result? He was found liable in a civil case overwhelmingly by the jury, but not guilty in the criminal case.
How do you answer that question for yourself? It goes to the heart of a question any lawyer must ask themselves about their concept of the system and belief in the system. Have there been people who, through your defence, have walked free who are in every likelihood guilty? And if that's the case, how do you answer that to your own system of ethics?
Well, I've had both. I've had guilty people go free, and I've had innocent people be convicted. When an innocent person is convicted, that represents a total breakdown in the system. It's only happened to me in my experience once, but it was devastating to me. And the other has happened on more than one occasion. The difference is this. Convicting an innocent person is a breakdown of the system. Acquitting a guilty person is part of the system because our system and your system reflects Blackstone's dictum that it's better for 10 guilty people to go free than for one innocent to be wrongly convicted. So we have rules like proof beyond a reasonable doubt and heavy burden of proof and exclusionary rules that presuppose that guilty people will occasionally go free. But we have nothing in our system that ever justifies an innocent person being wrongly convicted.
You've been described as the attorney of last resort for desperate and despised. Mm-hmm, this was an LA Times writer. Right. Apart from what you've just described, are there other things that would cause you to take a case that others would not?
Well, I think the perfect example, I haven't taken the case, but I've been on television a lot arguing against charging President Trump with crime. I do that not because I supported Trump. I didn't. I was a very, very ardent supporter of Hillary Clinton. I contributed to her campaign. I campaigned for her. I regard her as a close personal friend. I was devastated when she lost the election. But I don't believe that Trump has been treated fairly by our legal system. And so I have been not serving as a defense attorney or a surrogate for him, but standing up for the Constitution. And that has gotten me into so much trouble with my liberal friends and colleagues. I've lost 7 pounds on what I call the Trump diet. My liberal friends don't invite me to dinner anymore. So the only good thing is I'm in better shape.
Of the court cases, however, same thing. Would your mind be attracted to something that offered you an interesting legal opportunity?
Yes. Look, because I was a law professor for 50 years, I could afford to take cases that nobody else could take. I could afford to stand up for the rights of Nazis marching through Skokie. I could afford to stand up for cases involving members of the Ku Klux Klan, including people who hated me and wanted to kill me. At one point, I was asked to represent a young neo-Nazi. And when we couldn't agree because I wanted to contribute his fee to gay rights organizations, women rights organizations, black rights and Jewish rights organizations, he wouldn't accept that. He put out a contract on my life, and I had to be protected by the FBI for weeks at a time. So I feel strongly that everybody's entitled to a defense and that I am the lawyer of last resort because I can afford to do it, having had tenure at Harvard and, you know, having financial independence because of the other cases that I take. So I still see myself as somebody who people can come to if they can't get another lawyer to represent them. And I do 50% of my cases pro bono without charge.
What makes a great legal mind? And in this time that we have just been discussing, where everything, it seems, can be assessed and dismissed in 140 characters, are we still producing them?
Well, I can't tell you what makes a great legal mind. I can tell you what makes a pretty good legal mind, because I think I have a pretty good legal mind, paying attention. I teach my students not to take notes. You have to listen, and you have to listen with every pore in your body. And everything you do has to be reactive and in the moment. And lawyers who can listen and understand and see the nuance are the ones who can be very persuasive. On the night before a jury trial or even the few days before, I travel in the subways. I watch the kind of television I wouldn't normally watch. I want to know what the average person is thinking, what's in their mind. I go on the social media. I see what's trending. And I try very hard to speak to the concerns of the average person. I guess politicians do the same thing, but when you're in front of a jury, it's not so different from when you're in front of voters.
Professor Alan Dershowitz is our guest, 50 years a professor of law at Harvard University, as well as a courtroom lawyer in some very high-profile cases. You're listening to 9 to Noon on RNZ National. We talked then about some of the challenges confronting US politics, confronting US media, and confronting the law itself. It seems many of the institutions are undergoing some tumult at the moment. And a further change upsetting the establishment status quo, certainly Hollywood, the media and politics, is the hashtag MeToo phenomenon. What do you make of this? What is it? Some kind of social revolution, and will it last?
Well, first, it's very, very important to expose what has been an open secret for years, how men have taken advantage of women in so many hierarchical situations, including academia, and certainly in Hollywood, and certainly in business and in law firms as well. But of course, whenever you see wide pendulum swings, they often swing far too widely. Now, what concerns me is we're seeing censorship, major, massive censorship. We're seeing the censorship of art in museums. Chuck Close, for example, his art has been excluded from museums because of allegations against him. We're seeing a censorship of musicians, people like James Levine, the greatest opera conductor in modern history, can no longer play at the Metropolitan Opera. We're seeing books being essentially taken out of libraries. We're seeing a new kind of sexual McCarthyism, and it worries me greatly. There have to be consequences, but the consequences shouldn't fall so broadly on the artistic public, on people who attend music events. We have to figure out a way of making sure that no woman is ever victimized in a hierarchical situation, and we have to praise Me Too for bringing that to the surface. But the consequences have to also take into account the fact that if we started taking artists out of museums who have abused women, what do we do with all of Picasso's paintings and Renoir's paintings and Degas and Rodin? All of them have histories. What do we do with the writings of Plato and the teachings of Thomas Jefferson? This is part of a larger trend of taking statues down. And my daughter, for example, who's a professional actor, was in a wonderful play in San Francisco about Jefferson and Sally Heming. And the play posed the question, could you have real love between a slave owner and a slave? It didn't answer the question. It posed it. And tremendous efforts were made to ban the play because that question doesn't deserve to be asked. Every question of that kind deserves to be asked. And so we have to be concerned, as a civil libertarian, I certainly am concerned, about the other side of Me Too and the other side of taking down statutes and the impact it will have on the open marketplace of ideas.
It is interesting with any revolutions how they rise up, they gain this tremendous sense of force, but often ultimately succumb to the pre-existing power structures. And when we look at this current situation, which has led to resignations of very powerful people in Hollywood, in senior political situations and in the media, where previously money would have talked perhaps in legitimate cases and there would have been settlements or there would have been defamation lawsuits or the testing of allegations in the courts, they've gone. And why have they gone? Have they gone because the publicity has outweighed the ability of the system to be used to defend themselves? What's different?
I think what happened is, of course, process takes time. And when you have a movement like Me Too, you want speed. You want to see results immediately. You want to see Steve Wynn resign within a week after he was accused and denied. You want to see Harvey Weinstein thrown out of his company immediately. You don't have time for process. Process can take months and even years, but process is the essence of democracy. Some cases are so clear, but there's also a lot of hypocrisy. My grandson was flying over with us to New Zealand, and he watched on the plane the movie The Pianist. And, of course, The Pianist was produced and directed by a man who was accused of doping and having sex with a 13-year-old, Roman Polanski. And yet he got a pass for some reason for many, many, many years. He got a standing ovation at the Oscars. And so by some of the same people who now immediately demand that resignations occur. So there's some fear that there could be a faddishness to some of this. I hope not, because it's a serious, serious issue. And the women who have brought this to the forefront have to be praised. But you always have to worry about the overreaction and the need for swiftness. Swiftness and justice do not go together.
It's interesting thinking of justice in its broadest sense, and I'm thinking here again about the real difference being the impact of social media, including on companies' bottom lines, right? You mentioned some cases are so clear. That's an interesting observation to make as well. But you see, someone sitting back and looking at a century of history might say, has a century of careful journalism that has been very meticulous about defamation laws and has a century of due process in the courts deliver justice to entire classes of people, mm-hmm. or has 1 year of absolutely it's all out there in the way this mini-revolution, if we call it that, has happened, tilted the balance somewhat. It's interesting as to what justice is. You as a lawyer and a law professor clearly have a perspective, and oppressed people or peoples may have a different perspective.
I think that's right, and I think lawyers may over-process issues, and certainly there's some truth to the fact that in a very short period of time, more ultimate justice was achieved than had been achieved for a long, long, long period of time. But process is very important, particularly when you have institutions over time. And whether you can ever retrieve process if you've given it up is a difficult question. Look, all revolutionaries on the right and on the left want to do away with process. They know the truth with a capital T. There's no reason to have dissenting points of view because I think the very same motivations that push against process in the Me Too also push against free speech on university campuses today. The hard left does not want to hear opposing points of view. They know the truth. They know that issues of race and gender and the environment, they know the truth. And why allow dissenting views to be heard on campus? That's a very disturbing trend because remember, today's students are tomorrow's leaders.
Again, have we seen this in relatively recent times in the United States? I mean, you mentioned McCarthyism. There have mm-hmm. been extremes, well and truly, when it comes to freedom of speech in your country. But do you fear for some of the fundamental tenets that we have already traversed today, or are they just facing a periodic challenge as any healthy institution might?
I think every healthy institution has to face challenge, and I welcome challenge even to my absolute views of free speech and my views of due process. They deserve to be challenged. I did a review last week in the Washington Post of a book that was entitled Do We Have to Defend the Free Speech of Nazis? And, you know, the authors made some interesting points. In the end, I think their arguments were unpersuasive. The answer is yes, we have to defend the rights of Nazis or else we will have difficulty defending the rights of Martin Luther King. And when I mentioned that to, again, my grandson today, he said, but Grandpa, don't you see the difference between Nazis and Martin Luther King? And I said, of course I do, but the Constitution doesn't. The Constitution is neutral when it comes to free speech. Now, of course, New Zealand doesn't have a written constitution, but you have a constitution, much like Britain has a constitution in the sense of you have long traditions and deeply entrenched laws, and you have a deep commitment to freedom of speech as well. So, you know, these are issues that may be more exaggerated in the United States because we have very, very powerful words in our First Amendment. Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. And it doesn't provide for balancing, for example, in regard to hate speech or other kinds of speech or Holocaust denial. I mean, I find myself in the position of defending Holocaust deniers' right to speak, even though many of my own relatives perished during the Holocaust. And my mother, who died at 95 and was uneducated but brilliant, she didn't understand. She said to me, you know, son, whose side are you on? Are you on the side of the Jews or the Nazis? I said, Ma, I'm on the side of the First Amendment. She said, I'm your mother. Don't give me that. You have to pick. You either have to be on the side of the Jews or the Nazis. I'm hearing that again today from very educated people. You have to pick. Are you on the side of Trump or are you on the side of decency and goodness? And my answer is, again, I'm on the side of process and the Constitution, and that's never going to be popular.
You mentioned you have spoken and advised very senior figures, again, across party lines. I think mm-hmm. You're on record as having discussed President Trump's Middle East policy with him.
Right.
And I think he mentioned to you in that conversation he was going to move on announcing Jerusalem as the capital. Mm-hmm. I've also read that you're a confidant to the Israeli Prime Minister, yes. Benjamin Netanyahu. He's just in the news right now, of course, with this advice of the police that he ought to be, or charges ought to be pursued against him. Are you at all involved or advising him? What's his future going to be here with this situation?
Well, Benjamin Netanyahu has been my friend for close to a half century. I met him when he was in his young 20s. As a student at MIT, we have very different politics. I would be much more on the left if I were an Israeli voter. And, of course, the Israeli system does have a tradition that if you've been indicted, you step down as prime minister. He has not been indicted, but the police have recommended prosecution. One of the cases sounds like a very terrible precedent that would be established. He is accused of having had a conversation with the publisher of a newspaper in which he said, if you give me and my family better coverage, I will help you get some legislation passed. My God, if every prime minister and president were to be charged with making deals like that with the press, we'd have a very, very large number of people in prison today. That sounds like politics as usual. The other one is a matter of degree. Obviously, he was given cigars and champagne by friends, but I haven't seen any evidence that would suggest a quid pro quo. Friends do favors for friends. We had a recent case where a senator named Bob Menendez was convicted, and they just basically threw out the case. He wasn't convicted. He had a hung jury, and the Justice Department just threw out the case. And he was accused of helping a friend and the friend helping him. There should be laws against that, but there aren't. And you should not be prosecuting people, whether it's Trump or Netanyahu, on matters of degree. The law should have to be crystal clear. I think it was Thomas Jefferson who said, the law should be so clear that you can read it and understand it while running. And I think the laws under which Netanyahu and Trump are being investigated don't meet that high standard for criminal prosecution.
I understand it may be up to the Attorney General in Israel to whether charges are pursued, and that could be a lengthy process.
It could be, but the Attorney General of Israel is interesting. He's non-political. He's non-partisan. He's not like the Attorney General of the United States, appointed by the president. The prime minister has literally no control currently over the Attorney General. He can't fire him the way Trump could but won't fire Mueller or the Attorney General of the United States. So it'd be interesting to watch this Attorney General.
That's Alan Dershowitz. He's just been in the country as a guest of the law firm Minter Ellison Rudd Watts and the Ray Friedman Trust.